This is edition number 2009 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 20th of March 2026. Hello, you're listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 19th of March 2026. My name is John Hoyle, and my fellow readers are
Imogen Waterson,
Lorna Wilson,
and Beau Williams.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 5:50 and will set at about 6:15.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme, and to welcome the spring in, it includes the Big Five of Scotland, cherry blossom in a Japanese garden, endangered turtle doves, and the sounds of more common native birds to listen out for in your garden.
But we begin with the main news items, which include the imminent release of rarely seen Doctor Who episodes from the 1960s, a Norfolk flood warden remembered in a street sign, a few arrests, and the reopening of part of the Sheringham Promenade. Let's start with those lead stories.
Tony Andrews was often seen striding the Walcott seafront, keeping a watchful eye on the tides and warning those living nearby of any dangers. Following his death at the age of 69 in 2020, many paid tribute and described him as a genuine, caring man who was always on hand to help anybody with anything. Now his name has been written on the map in Walcott, the village he lived in his entire life. Last week his wife Sylvia Andrews and daughter Kerry Warby cut the ribbon to the new Andrews Way at the new flagship homes development off Ostend Road. Mrs. Andrews said, "I'm really pleased. He spent all his life in Walcott. Tony was always helping everybody else and was up night after night with the other wardens." Tens of villagers joined to watch and be part of the ceremony in memory of him. Pauline Porter, chairwoman of the parish council and senior flood warden, said, "He was one of the founding members of the Walcott Emergency Volunteers Association. He spent many, many nights out there in the wet and the cold, along with his wardens, so we could sleep safely in our beds. For 40 years, Mr. Andrews and his team gained knowledge of the oncoming seas and spotted the danger zones, as well as organising evacuations. In 2018, both Mr. and Mrs. Andrews retired from the Walcott Emergency Volunteers Association, but they never stopped helping others when needed." Flagship Homes Senior Project Manager Stephen Jones said, "He played a vital role as a flood warden. The new development, called the Sandpipers, consists of 23 affordable homes."
Nearly 40,000 guests are expected to stay overnight in a Norfolk town's new Premier Inn a year, it has been revealed. The major chain announced it had eyed up part of the former Crane Fruhauf factory site off Cromer Road in North Walsham for a new 81-bed hotel last month. If approved, it would be North Walsham's first branded hotel and would sit next to Waitrose, MKM Builders Merchants and Tom Moore House. In a statement, it said the proposed development is expected to accommodate around 36,800 overnight visitors annually, on the basis of an estimated occupancy rate of 83% for the hotel. It has said that guests could be expected to spend up to £3.5 million per year, with £1.8 million estimated to be put into the town's local economy annually. This shows that the Premier Inn guests spend an average of £143 per room per night, with £71 typically spent within a 2-mile radius of the hotel. The development would include Premier Inn's latest room design, a guest lounge, 80 parking spaces and landscaping. Whitbread PLC, which owns Premier Inn, expects the hotel to create around 20 to 22 permanent hospitality jobs. The site was previously home to the former Crane Fruithof factory, which had manufactured trailers and containers. It had ceased operations in 1999 and was demolished. While some of the land has been redeveloped with new stores and offices, the application site earmarked for the hotel has been vacant for 26 years. The planning statement said the proposal will make efficient use of the previously developed land and will bring it back into active use, delivering new visitor accommodation and new jobs. To view or comment on the plan, search PF26/0451 on the NNDC planning portal.
Norfolk Constabulary has been responding to reports of potential Nottingham knockers around North Norfolk, including in Cromer, Aylmerton and Gresham. Nottingham knockers are cold callers who travel the UK knocking on doors and trying to sell low-quality household items at inflated prices. They usually claim they were recently released from prison and are trying to earn some money. A spokesman for North Norfolk Police said, "In these circumstances, we would advise people to make sure their house is secure front and back before answering any doors, and if you don't recognise the person, to consider only speaking to them through a closed, locked door, if at all. Tell them you are not interested and ask them to leave despite any persistence. We would always advise you not to agree to buy goods from or have work done by anyone who calls unannounced or approaches you in the street. Sometimes such traders are operating fraudulently and will target vulnerable residents. Those who feel threatened should call 999 immediately."
It is as good as Norwich City winning the FA Cup on penalties. That is the reaction of a Norfolk Doctor Who fan after two episodes of the sci-fi show, which have not been seen for more than 60 years, were found in a cardboard box. Fans of the BBC show are celebrating after episodes of the 1965 story of the Daleks' master plan were found by the Film is Fabulous, FIF, initiative in a collection of vintage films. Among Doctor Who enthusiasts who were thrilled about the discovery was Norwich fan Paul Hayes, the author of Pool to Open, a book about the origin of the programme and its first episodes. He said, "It's difficult to convey to people who aren't fans the sheer thrilling excitement of something like this for those who love Doctor Who. Imagine you'd just seen Norwich City win the FA Cup final in a penalty shootout, and you might be somewhere close." The episodes feature the first incarnation of the Doctor, played by William Hartnell, tackling a Dalek plan to take over the solar system in a storyline only ever shown in the UK. The first episode, titled The Nightmare Begins, was part of the third season of Doctor Who and was aired in November 1965. The second recovered episode, Devil's Planet, was broadcast 2 weeks later. Cromer-based Mark Stuckey, a panel member of FIF and a star on BBC's The Repair Shop, said, "It's an exciting time and this is just the beginning. It takes you back in time." Mr. Stuckey, at the age of 7, sat down and watched the very first episode in 1963. He said it had influenced and changed his life. These two episodes are the first lost Doctor Who episodes to be announced to the world since 2013, and they reduce the number of missing episodes to 95. A special screening of the two episodes organised by FIF, with Peter Purves, who played the Doctor's assistant, Stephen Taylor, as guest of honour, is being held in London on April the 4th. Details are yet to be announced, but on the same day, the two restored episodes will be available in full on BBC iPlayer. Film is Fabulous is a charitable trust which preserves and saves film collections and television episodes from being destroyed before sending them back to the original copyright holders so they can once again be enjoyed by viewers. The organisation is seeking donations to help it carry on its work. Find out more on its Facebook page.
A man has been arrested on suspicion of dangerous driving and failing to stop after a car crashed into a parked ambulance. Police were called to Angel Court in Cromer Road, North Walsham, just after 10 p.m. on February the 19th, following reports that a car had collided with a parked ambulance. No one was injured, but the driver failed to stop at the scene. Police have now confirmed a man in his late teens has been arrested in connection with the incident. He was taken to Great Yarmouth Police Investigation Centre for questioning on suspicion of aggravated vehicle taking, dangerous driving and failing to stop, driving otherwise than in accordance with a licence and driving without insurance. He has been bailed to appear at Great Yarmouth PIC on April the 28th.
Two men who were arrested following a drug-fueled chase after ramming into a police car have been bailed. Officers were called at 9:22 p.m. on February the 16th to a store in Blue Boar Lane, Sprowston, on the outskirts of Norwich, after reports that people in a car were taking drugs. An officer arrived and parked behind the car, which then reversed into the police vehicle several times before fleeing the scene. A short time later, two men were seen running along the same lane and were chased on foot by officers. One was caught while the second was stopped as he headed back towards the store. Both men in their 20s and from Holt were arrested on suspicion of failing to stop for an officer, criminal damage and drug driving. They were each additionally arrested on suspicion of possession of nitrous oxide for wrongful inhalation and aggravated taking a vehicle without consent. This followed after a report was made by a resident in Sheringham at around 11 p.m. that his vehicle had been stolen from his driveway on Beach Road. A spokesman for the force has now confirmed that the men have been bailed to appear at Wyndham PIC on May the 5th.
A machete-wielding man who circled another boater on the Norfolk Broads has sailed free due to a lack of evidence. The usually still waters of the Broads became rather choppy at about 9:45 a.m. on March the 3rd in Barton Turf. The man, who was in possession of a machete, was seen intimidatingly orbiting another person on the water. At least three police cars and a forensic van were called to Staithe Road to investigate the incident. But the knife man had already sailed off by the time they arrived, sparking a police investigation. It has since emerged that no further action will be taken in the investigation. It did not fulfil the evidence threshold needed for prosecution, a police spokeswoman said. No one was injured during the incident.
Promenade reopens. A promenade which was closed due to a large void found beneath it has now been reopened. North Norfolk District Council had closed a stretch of the walkway at Sheringham 2 months ago after discovering the void. Initial investigations described the hole on the eastern end of the beach as large enough to accommodate a transit van, and work began to fill it last month. Now the council has announced that the work has been completed and the section of the promenade has now been reopened to the public. In a post online, the council said, "We would like to thank you for your cooperation during these works." Brian Farrow, coastal engineer at the council, had previously explained what may have caused such a large sinkhole. He said the 1920s seawall was founded on chalk, a soluble material which the sea can cut through, and behind it there is sand and gravel, which are then easily washed once the water cuts through the underside of the wall.
Our next few news stories include a new TV programme filmed partly in Norfolk, new funds allocated to community green space projects, support for a local sportsman, and encouragement to get your will written down.
Two stars filmed scenes for their new Channel 5 show in Norfolk. Salmonade Go Birding will follow actors Samuel West, who starred in All Creatures Great and Small and Slow Horses, and Adrian Edmondson of Alien, Earth and A Spy Among Friends fame as they travel the country on a bird-watching quest. During the three-part series, they will visit North Norfolk, looking for Brent and pink-footed geese. They will also visit West Cornwall, looking for Cornish choughs, and the Somerset Levels, where they stake out kingfishers, egrets, and the elusive bittern. West and Edmondson are coming into it with different levels of bird-watching experience. For West, birding is a long-standing passion. He's been recording his sightings for 20 years and has now seen more than 400 British species. The hobby is something new to Edmondson. "Watching birds is a simple pleasure," West said. "At heart, it's an invitation to connect with the natural world. All you need is a desire to look, listen and enjoy. A pair of binoculars helps. A friend to share it with makes it even better. I'm thrilled that we get to invite the audience along with us on our travels. They've already proved how tasteful and clever they are by liking All Creatures Great and Small so much." Edmondson added, "I don't know how I got to be this old without knowing more about birds. I feel like it's a huge hole in my education. Sam is going to fill me in, and we get to go to a pub." The programme is expected to air in 2026, but specific dates are yet to be revealed.
Age UK Norfolk is urging people to plan for later life by making a will, setting up a lasting power of attorney, LPA, considering future care needs and ensuring they receive all the benefits they are entitled to. Emma Harkness, Head of Information and Advice at Age UK Norfolk, said, "Planning for later life is at the heart of our advice work. All our services are free to access, including our support to complete lasting power of attorney forms. As an organisation, we believe everyone who wants an LPA should be able to have one, and that cost should not be a barrier. The charity can direct people to trusted solicitors and provide information about Free Wills Month. It also offers free, confidential advice and benefit checks. Older people, families and carers can contact Age UK Norfolk on 0300 500 1217 or email advice@ageuknorfolk.org.uk. Details of community outreach sessions across the county are available on their website.
Long-distance runner Logan Smith from Cromer has received support from Crayford and ABS in his bid to compete in the 2028 Olympic Games in Los Angeles. The dealership has made a generous donation to help Mr. Smith take part in the 50-kilometre World Championships in New Delhi. Kevin ABS, Managing Director at Crayford and ABS, said, "The entire Crayford and ABS team are delighted to support Logan and wish him every success. The race took place on Sunday, March the 14th. The 28-year-old was placed 22nd in the 2025 London Marathon with a time of 2 hours, 15 minutes and 23 seconds and has competed in major marathons across Europe, including Frankfurt and Valencia. Mr. Smith said competing for his country is a lifelong dream, but one that requires major personal sacrifice. All funds raised were helping Mr. Smith focus fully on race preparation.
13 community projects, which will mean improved footpaths, wildflower meadows and the restoration of woodland, are to get a share of £50,000 awarded from Broadland District Council's Future for Nature Fund. The fund supports initiatives which restore natural habitats, capture carbon and improve public access to green spaces. The successful projects picked to get money from the Council's fund include Strumpshaw, a circular walk around Buckenham Woods, Wroxham, a wildflower meadow and natural shrubs at Colm Meadow, South Walsham, regenerating an existing pond, Little Plumstead, restoring woodland and improving access to green space behind the walled garden, Cantley, restoring an existing pond and circular route, Reedham, restoring the Reedham Woodland Walk, Brundle, a new pond at Brundle Countryside Park, Ringland, restoring one ghost pond and two existing ponds, Old Catton, creating tree-lined avenues in Oakfield Gardens, St Faith's Community Volunteer Group, regenerating woodland by re-establishing drainage ditches and clearing invasive species, Aylsham, improving public access to green spaces through the Aylsham Green Spaces Trail, Lingwood, a new community garden with orchard and a public footpath, Helsdon, extending an existing mini forest and adding new shrub areas to support wildlife. Green Councillor Jan Davis, Broadland District Council's portfolio holder for environmental excellence, said, "The Future for Nature Fund empowers our communities to take action for the environment. These projects not only protect and restore vital habitats, but also create accessible green spaces for residents to enjoy for generations to come. The projects will share £50,804 from the Future of Nature Fund, with a further £10,000 provided through Section 106 developer contributions, bringing the total investment to more than £60,000. You are listening to edition number 2009 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 20th of March 2026. Still to come, there are items about planning and community matters, and of course the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, letters to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
Fiona Turner of Antingham writes, "In these times of global and national turbulence with wars and economic uncertainty, there might be people around us who we take for granted, such as emergency workers. The police, ambulance, fire service, Coast Guard, RNLI, doctors, nurses, and other support staff are required to respond quickly to any number of challenging and sometimes distressing situations. Add to them the non-emergency but vital staff such as teachers, who may have to be extra vigilant in schools for the safety of students, the care workers who turn up to care for the disabled or elderly in care homes, the mail and parcel delivery services who are weaving through traffic to bring our goods to us, and the plumbers, electricians and other trades who patiently take the calls from us when things go wrong. I can't help thinking, as some politicians rage and compete with each other like spoilt celebrities on a game show, that it's the unselfish, dedicated and often overlooked key workers in our society who hold everything together. Please support them. They have families they may be worried about too. They have personal lives that may not be going well too. And they too may be tired and feel unappreciated when they respond to either our emergency or domestic needs. But they do care. There is also a strong culture of voluntary work in North Norfolk, which is really impressive. I remember my grandmother, who lived through the Second World War, saying that in a strange way, people seemed happier as a community during these difficult years. When I asked why, she replied, "Because people weren't so selfish and everyone worked together."
Callum Ringer, North Norfolk District Councillor, writes, "The proposed closure of Corpusty Primary School would be a serious loss for the village and the wider community it serves. If the Synergy Multi-Academy Trust believes it cannot continue to operate the school, closure should not automatically be the outcome. In those circumstances, the school should be returned to local authority maintained status so that Norfolk County Council has the opportunity to run it, rather than allowing a rural community to lose its school permanently. Closing a primary school should not be treated as the easy way out when an academy trust is facing financial pressures, particularly where other options have not been properly explored. Measures such as catchment realignment have not been meaningfully pursued, and 38 new homes approved as part of the neighbourhood plan, partly to support the long-term viability of the school, are about to be built, with construction about to get underway. Moving to closure before those homes are occupied is short-termism that we should be trying to move away from. Village schools sit at the heart of their communities, and once they are closed, it is extraordinarily difficult to reopen them. For that reason, no final decision on Corpus's future should be taken by the Department for Education until after the forthcoming County Council elections. A new administration must have the opportunity to carry out proper due diligence and consider all options before an irreversible decision is made."
Bill Edney from Corston writes, "The dramatic increase in price of domestic heating fuel is nothing less than a scandal. The oil in the suppliers' tanks and at the depots was probably paid for weeks ago, when the average price was around 65 pence per litre. So why an immediate doubling of the price to the customer? Conversely, petrol rose by about 6.8%. Also, even if the price of a barrel of crude oil is now costing around $110 per barrel at the time of writing, that commodity won't reach our shores for weeks. Either way, someone is definitely gaining from this crisis. And now to this week's obituaries.
A chef and restaurateur who was once praised by Lionel Richie and the Commodores for giving them the best meal has died aged 84. John Fountain had a long and successful career across the county, running restaurants and food businesses with his husband and business partner, Derek Riches. Their first restaurant together was Woodford's, based in Sheringham's High Street, which they ran from 1973. It was here in 1979 they were visited by the Commodores, who shared a signed photograph along with a high commendation of the food, stating, "The best meal we've had in all of the United Kingdom, including London." From there, the couple opened Green Farm in Thorpe Market, based between Cromer and North Walsham, from 1976 to the early 1980s, where they hosted popular celebration-themed food nights. Mr. Fountain was the accomplished chef leading in the kitchen, designing mouth-watering menus and speciality dishes. His husband, meanwhile, worked front of house, meeting, greeting, entertaining and serving the guests. Their next venture together was the conversion of an old garage and petrol station forecourt into unique restaurant, the Garage Diner on Grove Road, Norwich. Opened in 1982, it was popular for all ages, even hosting a visit from 1960s singer Joe Brown, as well as winning floral awards in Norwich in Bloom's annual competition. After the diner, the couple opted for something different and opened Smart Tarts in Sprowston, with Mr. Fountain cooking an array of home-cooked pies, tarts and savoury delights. Although the business name initially caused concern among residents, a story that previously featured in this newspaper, it quickly became a firm favourite, and people travelled far and wide to savour the tarts and pies. Their final enterprise before retirement in August 2002 saw them return to the restaurant business, and in 1994 they took over the establishment Gachet in Weybourne near Sheringham. Mr. Fountain again led the kitchen and continued to retain the long-established high reputation of the restaurant, with customers returning again and again to enjoy the culinary experience. The couple enjoyed much of their well-earned retirement in Spain, while always retaining a home in Norfolk, the place Mr. Fountain was born and raised in. Paying tribute, his loved ones said, "Many will remember John not only for his incredible food, but his great wit, warmth and generosity to his customers, family and friends. A life well lived. He'll be sorely missed and fondly remembered by many across Norfolk and beyond." Mr. Fountain died on Tuesday, March the 3rd, at Horning near Wroxham.
And now some articles about local events and establishments to tempt you out and about as the days get lighter and warmer around us.
The 8th Horning Boat Show is being held adjacent to the River Bure on Saturday, May the 2nd. From 10 a.m. until 4 p.m, exhibitors will show off luxury motor cruisers and sailing boats, plus many other marine products and services. Norfolk Broad's holiday companies will also be at the event, alongside charity stalls and a classic car show. Horning Sailing Club will be putting on a Discover Sailing event, which has drawn huge crowds from around Norfolk each year. There will be a food court, with local food vendors, and pubs in Horning will also be open for the event's duration. The Village Hall will become a craft haven, and the Horning Boat Show auction will return too, with all funds raised going to local charities. Visitors can make the most of free entry to the event and free parking at nearby Bewilderwood. There will be a shuttle bus running throughout the day for a small charge.
Work at the Crown in Sheringham was part of a six-figure investment which will now see it sit in Stonegate Group's Pubsmiths division. The pub has refreshed interiors, upgraded lighting and furniture, and a relocated sidebar. New beach huts will provide ice cream and outside seating, and the pub's exterior has also had a paint job. 9 new jobs have been created as part of the investment, and the venue remains dog-friendly. Jamie Hogwood, regional manager for the area, said, "It's amazing to see the Crown looking so good after this huge investment. We can't wait to show everyone round. We've added to our team, the welcome's just as warm, and we've got loads of exciting events coming up. Customers can also enjoy a new food menu, and the pub will continue to sell takeaway pizzas after the main kitchen closes. The Crown has been licensed as a pub since at least 1781, but it has been rebuilt several times, and the current building dates from 1935.
Paul Martin, best known for presenting the BBC's Flog It, will be at the Cromer Pier Pavilion Theatre on May the 6th. He will offer live valuations and share stories from his 20-year career as a presenter. I'm thrilled to be returning to Norfolk and delighted to be supporting the landmark restoration of the Grade 2 Cromer Pier, a well-known Historic England protected heritage asset and a powerful reminder of the achievements of the Victorian engineers, Martin said. The event begins at 1 p.m, with Martin meeting guests in the pavilion bar and valuing items brought by the members of the public. All items valued on the day will be consigned for sale by auction at Henry Aldridge & Son Limited, where Martin serves as head of valuations. At 3 p.m. he will present an on-stage talk featuring 30 selected objects. The day will conclude with a book signing of his title, Paul Martin, My World of Antiques.
An award-winning magician is bringing his 24K magic show to Cromer. Danny Lee Grew, who made his Cromer debut in 2024 as a guest star in the Cromer Pier Summer Show, will return to the Pavilion Theatre on April the 10th as part of his 200-show UK tour. Mr. Grew said, "It is one of those rare art forms where it is better when it is live. When you see it for yourself in the flesh and there is no way it can be a camera trick, it catches people off guard." Known for his visual comedy-driven magic, Mr. Grew has performed for audiences including David Beckham, James Corden and Stormzy. He also appeared in the Cromer Pier Christmas show alongside Ollie Day. One of his signature illusions involves transforming a single flower petal into an egg, which he then breaks into a glass. Mr. Grew said, "My work is very visual. If people saw it on the telly, they would put it down to camera tricks." He also performs a classic Tommy Cooper routine that turns into pure comedy. At the age of 10, he joined the Young Musicians Club, the Magic Circle's youth program. He said, "Magic was a phase for me as a child that I simply never grew out of. I watched Sooty at the theatre and took part in school talent shows and won. My school careers advisor subtly suggested I come up with a backup plan. I remember telling them I wanted to be a magician and they didn't know where to go with that." He was recently named Stage Magician of the Year by the International Brotherhood of Magicians. To book tickets, visit the Pier's website.
After 3 decades in Cromer, the long-running Cromer Music Evenings concert series has moved to All Saints Church in Upper Sheringham, which has been hosting music events since 2023. Reverend Frank Clark, Honorary Assistant Priest and Events Organiser at All Saints, said, "Community use of churches is encouraged and helps to ensure their viability. In addition to our regular services, this ancient village church, parts of which date back to the 15th century, is acclaimed for its acoustics, making it a superb venue for the performance of live music. We're very much looking forward to our association with Cromer Music Evenings and to welcoming regular patrons and ours, but also music lovers from further afield. All will find a friendly welcome at All Saints." Keith Hobday, chairman of Cromer Music Evenings, said, "The series will continue to showcase talent." He said, "We'll continue to stage performances of a high quality by award-winning musicians with international reputations. The first concert of the season took place on February the 22nd, featuring young Norfolk musicians. Oboist Alina Lay, pianist Benedict Milne, violinist Isaac Shad, vocalist Ben Griffiths, and pianist Irina Olink performed to an appreciative audience. The next recital will feature Canadian guitarist Evan Dimm and will take place on March the 22nd at 3 p.m.
Disney Magic is coming to the stage with a local young actor set to make a splash. Georgiana Forder, 14, will star as Ariel in The Little Mermaid Junior at Sheringham Little Theatre from April the 7th to April the 11th. The Aylsham teenager said, "When I was younger, I loved Ariel in the Disney cartoon, and when we went to Walt Disney World in Florida 9 years ago, I met her. She kissed me, and I refused to wash her lipstick off. Back then, I never thought I'd be her, so I'm really excited." The show will feature a cast of 40 young performers aged 8 to 18. Sheringham Little Theatre's director, Debbie Thompson, said, "Little Mermaid is a favourite film of the children who are excited to be a part of it. And we know that youngsters in the audience love watching children on stage. It is inspirational, and some go on to get involved in future productions." Tickets are available from www.sheringhamlittletheatre.com or by calling the box office on 01263 822 347.
Haysborough RNLI volunteers are gearing up for their spring open day. The event, scheduled for March the 29th, will run from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the lifeboat station on Cart Gap. Attendees will have the chance to view the lifeboat up close and meet the crew. The day will be filled with a range of activities, including live music from Jay and Ross, a tombola, and various family-friendly games. Water safety activities will also be on offer, aimed at raising awareness and providing practical knowledge to visitors. A barbecue will be on site alongside other refreshments. The lifeguards who patrol the beaches will also be attending the event, with guests encouraged to learn about their vital role in coastal safety. The RNLI shop and visitor centre will also be open.
Egg designs created by schoolchildren are taking centre stage along a heritage railway this Easter. Pupils from Beeston Hall, Gresham's Pre-Pep, Kelling Primary School, Sheringham Primary School and Sheringham Woodfield School have lent their creativity to the North Norfolk Railway's Easter Express Trail. Each design forms part of a hunt running from Sheringham to Holt. Steam and diesel locomotives will run throughout the holiday. Visit www.nnrailway.co.uk.
A 32-acre garden nestled in the Norfolk countryside has been named the best in the country. East Ruston Old Vicarage, which sits between Honing and Haysborough, has been crowned the best garden to visit in the UK this spring. The title comes from a study conducted by leisure experts at the outdoor furniture outlet White Stores. It found its results by analysing 240 gardens listed by the Royal Horticultural Society and comparing their Google ratings, annual rainfall average temperature, hours of sunlight per year, numbers of facilities and variety of on-site attractions. East Ruston Old Vicarage boasts several features such as subtropical gardens, a glasshouse and sculptures. There are also toilets, on-site parking, a plant shop and an accessible garden layout, while assistant dogs are welcome. In 2026, it will be open from April the 1st until October the 31st. Rob Mead, buying director at White Stores, said, "These gardens offer more than a great day out for a family of all ages, and they're great inspiration for people looking to decorate their own outdoor spaces."
A professional theatre collective is set to bring the passion to Sheringham. The performance will take place at St Andrew's Methodist Church, Cromer Road, Sheringham, on Saturday, March the 28th at 3 p.m, with entry free of charge and donations welcome to help cover production costs. Staged by the Lamps Collective, the play retells the life, death and resurrection of Jesus from the perspectives of Peter, Mary Magdalene and a Roman centurion named Marcus. Suitable for those aged 11 and above, the show lasts about 75 minutes and has been praised for its direction, music and performance. Seating follows a first-come, first-served rule, and refreshments will be provided afterwards. Lamps, a group made up of writers, actors and musicians, anchors its work in Christian faith. The collective, whose name stands for Love, Acting, Music, Poetry and Stories, is touring the play nationally from March the 12th to April the 4th. Further information about the play and the performance can be found at lampscollective.com and sheringhammethodist.org.uk.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we celebrate the impending arrival of spring with a collection of articles about gardens and wildlife to focus our attention on the sound and feel of the great outdoors in springtime. Happy listening!
This article is written for the Mardler by Nick Marshall, with thanks to Nick Jenkins for his sound recordings. This is a quick run-through of some of the birdsong to be heard in Norfolk during the spring and summer months, though, as you will hear, the word song is a bit of a stretch, in the case of the sounds emanating from a couple of the birds we shall hear. I'll begin with three species of garden birds, and then move on to some birds found in other habitats in the county. We're all familiar with the blackbird, commonly found in gardens. Perhaps we think of it as a resident species. Many of our blackbirds are in fact migratory, arriving in the autumn from northeastern Europe just for the winter. Each year, they're one of the first birds to start singing. On warm days in January, their strong, fluty song can remind us that spring is on the way, and they'll continue singing till early July, often forming the backbone of the dawn chorus. About the size of a great tit, blackcaps are warblers, and like most warblers, are mainly summer visitors to the UK, spending the winter in Africa. A few blackcaps have long been known to winter in the UK, and it's been assumed that these birds simply do not migrate. There are evolutionary reasons why some individuals of a species will migrate and others not. Interestingly, though, it has recently been discovered through ringing recoveries that a kind of reverse migration is happening. Rather than going south for the winter, some birds from Eastern Europe are migrating east to west to winter in the warmer conditions of Britain and Ireland. Often referred to as the Nightingale of the North, their varied, rich and melodic song can be heard from April throughout the summer. Dunnocks are birds commonly found in urban gardens. They're about the size of a sparrow, but slimmer. A delicate mix of browns and bluey-grey, and with a shockingly defective moral compass. Their entertaining ménage à trois involving three birds all making overt sexual overtures to each other can often be seen in gardens. causing other birds to blush and look the other way. So, although the dunnock is not a secretive or skulking bird, it feeds rather mouse-like, largely on the ground, amongst low vegetation and leaves. They are non-migratory and sing from late winter to late summer. The song is quite high-pitched, compared with the last two species, fast-moving and sustained. North Norfolk has a good selection of heathland habitat, scattered trees, typically birch and Scotch pine, but predominantly heather, gorse and rough grass, such as the heaths at Salthouse, Kelling or Royden. Dusk on a warm June evening, a red sky fast succumbing to night as the ground radiates the day's heat, and distinctive heathland aromas infuse the warm, still air. The last of the bird song falls silent, and then... nothing evokes heathland at dusk like this extraordinary sound, the chirring of the nightjar. This nocturnal species is perfectly camouflaged to blend in with heathland colours as it roosts during the day. By night, it takes to the air with a buoyant, agile flight, its huge gaping mouth trawling for the moths which form its principal diet. Patches of dense scrub are often found on the edges of heaths, and these form habitat for the most well-known and celebrated songbird, the nightingale. Such an intense, dynamic sound from a bird not much bigger than a sparrow. But the season to hear them is short, from about mid-April, when the birds arrive from Africa, to mid-June. They've disappeared from many parts of Norfolk. It's thought largely because of loss of the dense, shadowy scrub they need. Keats wrote of the nightingale as a light-winged dryad of beechen green and shadows numberless. Dryads in Greek mythology are tree nymphs, whose fate is linked to the shadowy woodland they protect. Both flourish until nature's balance is upset, such as now by the introduction of hordes of non-native deer which obliterate the nightingale's habitat. And now for something completely different. It seems surreal that this sound known as booming could come from a bird, but this is the call of the bittern, a large heron-like species found in many of the extensive reed beds we have in Norfolk. The bittern is a conservation success story. It had virtually disappeared from the UK by the mid-1970s due to water pollution, but concerted work by the RSPB, Norfolk Wildlife Trust and other conservation bodies have brought it back from the brink. The reed beds of the Broads and those at Clye and Titchwell in spring and early summer are good places to hear bitterns booming in Norfolk. Bitterns are large brown birds of reed beds. A small brown bird, an LBJ in bird speak, little brown job, of reed beds is a warbler called, well, the reed warbler. They are summer migrants arriving in mid-April when the males immediately start to sing. Not a rare bird, but their persistent, scratchy song, rising above the gentle whispering of the breeze through the reeds, is such a defining sound of summer. The nest is suspended in mid-air, built off the ground, and woven in between two or three reed stems, it rises throughout the breeding season as the reeds gain height. An amazing engineering feat, especially for those nests which were invaded by another, much larger species, the European cuckoo. That most cogent harbinger of spring is well known for laying its eggs in the nests of other birds, particularly reed warblers. Cuckoos, do not select their host's nests randomly. Each individual cuckoo is genetically programmed to target nests of a single species, the colouring of the cuckoo's egg mimicking that of the eggs of the host species. Many of our cuckoos in East Anglia exclusively target reed warblers, and so they will spend the spring and early summer months around reed beds, waiting to pounce on the nest of a bird a fraction of its size, which is suspended in mid-air by a few reed stems. During the summer months, all of the sounds we've heard, apart from the nocturnal nightjar, might be accompanied by this, our final bird sound. This is the screaming call of swifts, another defining sound of summer, unrivaled masters of the air, never landing except to nest, sleeping on the wing, often above the clouds. They gather in groups to streak through the air, seemingly screaming their sheer joy to be alive. Birdsong is a fascinating subject in its own right and can only be a key aid to bird identification. To learn more about this, head for the phone app known as Merlin, then simply point the phone at any singing bird and it will instantly and reliably identify the bird.
This article from the National Trust magazine for Spring 2025 looks at the Japanese-inspired garden in Dorset. Japan's sakura season, cherry blossom season, begins towards the end of March. Towering cherry blossom trees, heavy with delicate flowers, line roadsides and fill parks with clouds of marshmallow pink petals catching the breeze, carpeting pavements and drifting lazily on the surface of rivers. Each year, the Japan Meteorological Corporation releases a special cherry blossom forecast, reporting the progress of the blooms. It's checked diligently by the crowds of locals and tourists who mingle beneath the blossom branches for the ritual of hanami, or flower watching. The mindful, joyful practice of gathering under cherry trees with family and friends for picnic parties and photographs. Hanami isn't only a time for celebration, it's also a reflective practice. Cherry blossom, as a cultural symbol, has been part of Japanese art, literature and design for centuries, representing both life and death. Today, with blossom's arrival marking the beginning of spring, its short and fleeting season is also considered a reminder that life is transient, so each moment should be treasured. When socialite Henrietta Banks of Kingston Lacey in Dorset visited the lavish Japan-British exhibition in the White City, London in 1910, she was captivated by the beauty of Japanese design. It was the largest display of Japanese culture that Europe had ever seen and was a chance to celebrate the relationship between Japan and the United Kingdom after the signing of the Anglo-Japanese Alliance in 1902. In a bid to improve Britain's perception of Japan and bolster trade, Japanese manufacturers showed their finest artworks, ceramics and furniture to more than 8 million visitors. Tickets were much in demand, and Henrietta would have rubbed shoulders with other members of British high society who'd flocked there. This period in history is an intricate puzzle, explained Assistant National Curator Emil de Brown, who specialises in Japanese and Chinese art collections. It was a form of soft power. In a cultural process of borrowing and exporting, the Japanese were creating a version of their culture to be consumed by the West. And consumed it was. The guests admired the fine Japanese craftsmanship on display. They posed for photographs dressed in kimono, observed sumo wrestling matches, and attended traditional tea ceremonies. The organisers had shipped shrubs and trees over from Japan to create lush gardens, complete with full-size ceremonial buildings, stone bridges and ponds swimming with glittering goldfish. The exhibition ran for just over 5 months, and the taste for Japanese design, which was already present in Britain, was given renewed impetus. Henrietta returned to her home in Kingston Lacey, brimming with ideas for how to commission her own sliver of Japan in the Dorset countryside. Kingston Lacey itself is a melding of architectural styles, none of them Japanese. The ancestral home of the wealthy Banks family has been remodelled and embellished over the centuries by a succession of owners, most notably renowned explorer and collector William John Banks between 1834 and 1855, who at 50 filled it with the paintings and fine objects that he collected and commissioned while abroad. When Henrietta took over the running of Kingston Lacey in 1904, the house was largely unchanged from William John's time. The wealthy socialite had married William John's descendant, Walter Ralph Branks, in 1897, but she was widowed just 7 years later. Left to care for Kingston Lacey until their son came of age in 1923, Henrietta devoted herself to upgrading the estate. Henrietta was on her own for a long time, says Kingston Lacey's curator, Elena Greer. She was a matriarch who oversaw the household, and she was closely involved in the running of the estate. She made lots of improvements to the house and helped to modernise it, including by introducing bathrooms and modern plumbing. Henrietta also used her practical flair to reform the garden. She planted a pioneering fernery with more than 40 varieties of fern, revived the formal parterre with flowers in suffragette colours, and transformed the kitchen garden. After the exhibition, Henrietta was inspired to bring something of what she'd seen of Japan back to her Dorset home. She picked out a 2.8 hectare, that's 7 acres, spot beside the path leading to the kitchen garden and drew upon the idealised version of Japan she'd seen at the exhibition to create her own beautifully calm Japanese garden. Surrounded by mature English trees and with a formal tea garden at its centre, it was a small and peaceful haven set with dense bamboo groves, meticulously pruned acers and feathery pines. We have letters in our archives that Henrietta wrote to local nurseries trying to sort specific acers and a catalogue of Japanese maples she selected from, says Steve. She ordered limestone from the family's Purbeck quarries to create her version of a Japanese landscape and built what she imagined a Japanese tea house would look like. She would ask servants to carry a tea service down from the house so she could take tea with her children. By the time Henrietta's son, Ralph Banks, gifted Kingston Lacey to the Trust in 1981, her Japanese garden had fallen into disrepair. 20 years on, the restored garden has settled into its Dorset landscape as though it has always been there. The garden team describe it as an English imagining of a Japanese garden. They've set their interpretation of Henrietta's tea garden at the centre, with a curving, dry stream, ornamental pond, and tea house with shoji doors. It's surrounded by several areas or rooms, including the path known as Ladies' Walk, that runs through the middle of the garden. the Acer Glade carpeted with wildflowers, and the Evergreen Garden. The UK's blossom season coincides with Japan's. In the spring, Ladies' Walk and the Evergreen Garden come to life in Kingston Lacey's own interpretation of Hanami. Plumes of pastel pink and creamy white cherry blossom pepper the paths and lawns, and visitors sit and stroll beneath the blooms. A gesture of friendship between Japan and the UK. The swathe of trees was gifted to the Trust as part of the Sakura Cherry Tree Project in 2021, which saw thousands of cherry trees planted in public spaces across the UK for everyone to enjoy. For Steve, who manages Kingston Lacey's formal garden, the Japanese garden has been a new challenge. You have to go into the space with a different mindset, he explains. In Japanese gardening, you control the plants as opposed to the plants controlling you. I come from a very English school of gardening, so there's been an element of unlearning for me. Steve and his team strive for authenticity, meticulously pruning the acers into traditional tigers and candling the spines, snipping away spring growth to create a perfect shape. He and his team work closely with the Japanese Garden Society to share knowledge and expertise. Members of the society, which is made up of UK-based Japanese gardening enthusiasts, visit the garden regularly to re-tie the traditional Ibu Misubi knots on the tea garden's symbolic Yotsume Gaki, or four-eye bamboo fence. As Sakura season approaches, the unpredictability of the English weather lends an element of peril to Kingston Lacey's blossom celebrations, with mid-season downpours or strong winds occasionally wiping out the flowers entirely. It's certainly a challenge, says Steve. We can never quite predict when the blossom is going to arrive or for how long it's going to last. But maybe that's part of the charm. In essence, Hanami is a celebration of the short, sweet lifespan of the cherry blossom, a symbol of hope and optimism for the year to come.
This article was written for the RSPB magazine in the spring-summer of 2024 by Jocelyn Ashpole, who is a species recovery officer for the RSPB. As the days grow longer and blossom and fresh green leaves spring into life here in the UK, a whole host of birds join us from more southern climes. Cuckoos, swallows, swifts, and of course turtle doves are just a few of the many species that bring life and song to our summer skies and dawn choruses. The turtle dove is a dainty bird with a chestnut tortoiseshell patterned wings and a striped neck. Flying thousands of miles from West Africa, turtle doves arrive in April and May to breed and raise the next generation of remarkable long-distance voyagers. They depart in August and September, flying south through Western Europe to West Africa, where they spend the winter in the savannah. In decades past, the turtle dove's tercercle, which features in its scientific name Streptopelia tertur, would have been a familiar sound of summer. These birds used to be found across large parts of England and Wales, but their range has shrunk dramatically. Turtle doves are on the UK's red list of birds of conservation concern. Their UK population fell 97% between 1995 and 2021. The 2021 National Turtle Dove Survey estimated that around 2,000 breeding territories remained in the UK, down from an estimated 125,000 in 1970. Their current strongholds are mainly limited to southeast and eastern England, where they tend to be found on farmland. Open, seed-rich habitats provide good places to feed, while thorny scrub and wide, tall, dense hedgerows are perfect for nesting. They use farm ponds, ditches and other shallow water sources for drinking and bathing. Why have turtle dove numbers declined so dramatically? Research shows that a loss of feeding habitat in the UK has had a major part to play. Seeds are crucial. Turtle doves eat them almost exclusively. But the plants that produce these seeds have become less plentiful over the years due to changes in agriculture. Despite these losses, there is hope, and that hope comes in the form of Operation Turtle Dove, a partnership project between Natural England, Penthorpe Conservation Trust, Fair to Nature, and the RSPB, which aims to help the UK's turtle dove population to recover. Nicole Kahn, Operation Turtle Dove Advisor for Kent, explains, "I've seen the number of people getting involved in helping turtle doves grow and grow. It is so rewarding to see this work paying off. And it's the hard work and dedication from hundreds of farmers and land managers that is turning things around for turtle doves. Take John Secker, who manages a wildlife stewardship scheme on an arable farm in Breckland, on the Norfolk-Suffolk border. He tells us, "We provide supplementary feed consisting of a mix of small seeds from mid-April and have created a network of 6-metre-wide cultivated margins around most of the fields on the farm. Annual disturbance of the soil by ploughing and harrowing provides perfect conditions for naturally occurring arable plants, which then yield the seeds that turtle doves require." Now working with Eliza Leet, Operation Turtle Dove Advisor for Suffolk, John is helping other farmers create suitable habitat for turtle doves through the Breckland Farmers Wildlife Network. For many years, prior to 2015, no turtle doves were seen on the farm. To see them back again, breeding and benefiting along with all the other birds, plants and invertebrates from the habitat we have created is very rewarding, says John. It's not just about traditional farms. Operation Turtle Dove is working with a whole host of other people who are managing their land for turtle doves. In Kent alone, Nicole's work covers a wide variety of land uses, from the likes of Chartham Vineyard, an artisan family vineyard, and Canterbury Golf Course, which recently won Ecological Project of the Year at the Golf Environment Awards for their work to support wildlife, including turtle doves. Nicole has also been working with a group of turtle dove enthusiasts in Kent who rallied together to buy a plot of land for the birds. David Burridge explains, "We purchased the land to provide turtle doves with a safe space to feed, and we have created a perimeter hedge, trees, nesting habitat, pond, and viewing hide. Turtle doves cross borders, and so too must conservation efforts. RSPB scientists have used GPS tags to understand more about the turtle dove's migration and carried out work in West Africa to understand their habitats. Meanwhile, an international action plan, published in 2018, brought together over 200 experts from 50 countries to discuss how to recover the turtle dove population across its range. As Guy Anderson, who leads the RSPB's Migratory Species Recovery Work, explains, this international collaboration kick-started action to tackle sustainable hunting. Until recently, every autumn, around 1 million turtle doves were legally hunted in France, Spain, and Portugal, the countries through which all UK breeding birds, along with their West European counterparts, migrate. Data showed these losses were unsustainable. As a result of the action plan, organisations worked together to develop a sustainable hunting management system, which the European Commission adopted. Consequently, turtle dove hunting was halted in all three countries in 2021, 22 and 23. This is an incredible turnaround, and we have every reason to be optimistic, says Guy. With unsustainable hunting being addressed, the impetus is now firmly on creating breeding season habitats for the birds. Helping species to recover takes time. However, we're already seeing glimmers of hope, and it's a really exciting time for turtle dove conservation. It's a huge team effort, and our thanks go out to everyone involved, whether you're an RSPB member or you're directly creating habitats for turtle doves. You are playing a vital role in supporting this important work. Here's to the future, where the gentle purr of the turtle dove is a familiar sound of summer once more. Listeners can help. Check out the Nature Friendly Farming Network website at nffn.org.uk to join and show your support to nature-friendly farmers who are leading the way to help turtle doves. Or, if you're based in southeast and eastern England, you can directly help turtle doves by creating habitat or working with your community to create a space for turtle doves. You can get in touch with your local turtle dove advisor via operationturtledove.org to find out more.
Anna Haynes wrote this article for the Caravan and Motorhome Club magazine in January/February 2026. While many are probably aware of the big five that can be seen on an African safari, you might not know that there is also a Scottish big five comprising the red squirrel, red deer, golden eagle, otter and common or harbour seal. For many years, Britain's lovable native squirrel has been under threat from disease and competition following the introduction of the North American grey squirrel. Scotland is home to around 80% of the UK's remaining red squirrel population, although numbers are slowly increasing across the nation thanks to successful rewilding projects. The woodlands of Angus and Perthshire are great places to spy these rascally creatures in action. Check out the designated squirrel feeding stations around the Loch of Kinnordy on the Leafy Loop Trail at Loch Leven, particularly in late summer and autumn when the adults are busy hoarding food for the winter. Signs of squirrel activity include the presence of drays, treetop homes resembling birds' nests with a few entrance holes, as well as piles of discarded pine cones, evidence of a recent dinner party in the trees above. Also, Scotland is home to the largest population of red deer in Europe. These majestic beasts are widespread in summer across hillside and mountaintop, descending in winter to shelter in the forests. Red deer are distinguishable from Scotland's other deer species, roe, fallow and seeker, by their size. They are the largest mammal in the UK, reddish-brown fur and paler tails. Mar Lodge Estate in the heart of the Cairngorm National Park has a healthy population of red deer, which can be seen on the fringes of Braemar Village and into the heart of the estate, frequently around the Lynn of Dee car park. According to countryside ranger Ben Dolphin, the autumn rut is a good time to visit the Lynn of Keogh and listen for the stags roaring, announcing their territory and intentions to the hinds. Care should be taken not to disturb them. While Ben says visitors should also be aware that many estates undertake their stalking activities during autumn. For a guaranteed encounter, head to the Red Deer Range in Galloway Forest, where deer can be observed from a designated viewing area and hide. The golden eagle is Scotland's most iconic bird and its number one predator. Exceptional hunters, they target rabbits, hares, grouse and foxes and have even been known to attack herds of deer. Although scarce, a 2015 survey recorded 508 breeding pairs. There are a handful of highland and island locations where you're almost guaranteed to catch a glimpse of the birds, which dominate the skyline with their impressive 2-metre wingspans. The hills around Ben Moor on Mull, for example, are excellent for golden eagles and their white-tailed cousins. Perched and soaring birds along ridgelines and prominent hilltops use updrafts to gain height. Bouncing back from the brink of extinction in the 1950s, there is now a thriving otter population in Scotland. At home in both marine and freshwater habitats, these sleek swimmers are the toughest of the big five to spot. Coastal encounters are more likely, with otters preferring sheltered waters at low tide, where feeding opportunities are abundant. They are best seen on calm days at dawn and dusk as they forage, surfacing and diving for a catch, while they typically then swim to shore to eat. The Moray Firth supports good numbers around the Black Isle and Shannonry Point. While it's possible to find otters in almost every inland waterway, I have it on good authority that a pair is currently thriving on one of Dundee's industrial estates, finding otters inland is tougher, with ditches and reeds providing sheltered foraging grounds. The River Spey has been designated as a site of special scientific interest, due in part to its otter population, with frequent sightings along the river outside the Speyside Visitor Centre in Aberlour. A lucky encounter will require a suitable stretch of waterway at dawn or dusk and a lot of patience. Realistically, you are more likely to spot signs of their presence, such as sprains, droppings, tracks and the remains of meals such as fish bones or crab shells, rather than the otters themselves. The common or harbour seal is by far the easiest animal to tick off the checklist, with numbers topping 20,000 around Scotland's coast, best witnessed at low tide haulouts on sheltered swathes of sand, mud and rocks. They can also be seen hunting offshore from many a clifftop or seaside town. Distinguishable from larger and more abundant grey seals by their round heads and close-set eyes and nose, grey seals have an elongated muzzle. Common seals have a distinctive banana profile, with their head and tail in the air when hauled out. Sizable colonies can be found on the west coast, with good numbers on Arran, basking on rocks around Blackwaterfoot and on the Corrie Shore. Common seals can be seen in smaller numbers on the east coast, especially around Loch Fleet in Sutherland, and hauled out with large numbers of grey seals on the sandbars of the Ithin estuary in Aberdeenshire.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our last few articles include planning and community matters from around the region.
Developers have unveiled plans for nearly 50 new homes and a graveyard extension in a Norfolk Market town. Phoenix Strategic Land has proposed to build 49 houses on land off Clye Road in Holt, alongside more burial plots and extra visitor parking at the town's cemetery. The housing development would range from 2 to 5 bedrooms, including one self-built plot, and will include new public open spaces and structural landscaping. The cemetery extension would be also delivered as part of the development, with the developers describing as a key element to the proposal, with the land intended to be transferred to the town council. Access will be provided via a new junction from Clye Road, serving both the new homes and cemetery parking areas. But before the firm submits a planning application to North Norfolk District Council, it has invited feedback from neighbours, businesses and community representatives to shape the final proposal. Daryl Kirkland, Joint Managing Director and Strategic Land Director at Phoenix Strategic Land, said, "We're pleased to be presenting our early proposals for new homes in Holt and to be able to support the town with an extension to the cemetery that has been identified by Holt Town Council as needed to increase capacity." He added, "From the outset, our priority has been to bring forward a high-quality, well-designed development that responds sensitively to its surroundings and delivers meaningful benefits for the local community. We're committed to working closely with the Town Council, residents and North Norfolk District Council, and we welcome feedback to help shape the final plans." The public consultation will run from March the 16th to April the 13th at 5 p.m. Full details of the proposals and information on how to provide feedback are available on the Phoenix Strategic Land website. Following the consultation period, all feedback will be carefully reviewed before a planning application is submitted to NNDC for consideration.
Tensions have flared in a Norfolk village after a target to build more than 40 new homes was agreed despite locals' concerns. North Norfolk District Council has earmarked Tunstead, which is a village in between North Walsham and Norwich, for 42 new homes to be built under the adopted local plan. The plan, which will run until 2040, allocates provision for thousands of new homes to different towns and villages, which will be considered when developers applying for planning permission. But this has sparked several fears for those living in the village, as well as a complaint from Tunstead and Scoruston Parish Council to the Planning Inspectorate, the government department that presides over planning matters. The parish council raised their concerns about the indicative number of homes, as well as the district council changing the village's classification from countryside to small growth village, despite the lack of services. Rob Hetherington, parish council vice chairman, said, "Our services have stayed the same, if not worsened, but the designation has changed. There is no sensible rationale in that. We don't have the services to cope with 42 homes. We need development that is right for our village. He added that North Norfolk District Council had made this decision without going to the village and did not take much notice as to what the council said. Tunstead is a sprawling village of about 420 homes and just over 700 residents, with a primary school, church, village hall, and the Horse and Groom pub, which is now set to reopen. Parish councillors had discussed seeking a judicial review, but after finding out that it would potentially cost £30,000, it was agreed to lodge a complaint with the planning inspectorate instead. Mr. Hetherington added that the council is not expecting the adopted plan to be changed, but said he is waiting for advice from the inspector about how to move forward. The parish council is also now developing the Tunstead neighbourhood plan, which can help guide where development should go in the village and what the village needs are, but not stop the growth. A NNDC spokeswoman has said that council officers met with the parish council in January to discuss their concerns and highlighted that the neighbourhood plan should be their main focus moving forwards.
A controversial housing development on the Norfolk coast is set to take a major leap forward today. Final plans to build 118 homes and a 60-bed care home in Cromer are set to be discussed by North Norfolk District Council. The proposal, submitted by Barrett David Wilson Homes Anglia, would transform the 6.4-hectare site between Overstrand Road and Northreps Road. And despite widespread objections from those living nearby, planning officers have recommended the bid be approved. Neighbours raised several concerns about the development, including flooding, loss of privacy, highway safety, and the pressure on local schools and doctors. The site, formerly used as a golf practice area, has rewilded over the last 20 years and is now seen by many as a valuable natural habitat. One objector said, "We local people value this rewilded green space bordering the town. It brings joy. A housing development, which will in all likelihood contain little to no social housing, will bring no joy to our community, just devastation of a valued space." Cromer Town Council echoed similar concerns and highlighted that no public transport statement was provided with the planning documents. The land was granted outline planning permission in 2024, and this reserved matters application, which details the appearance and layout of the development, was submitted in April last year. The plans include a mix of 53 affordable and 65 market properties, with a range of one-bedroom to four-bedroom homes set to be built. The planning officer has argued that there is not considered to be any significant overlooking, overshadowing, or overbearing as a result of the development, and that it complies with local plans. The council will make its decision on the application in a development committee meeting today.
Rising sports stars in North Norfolk can now apply for a support scheme offering free access to leisure centres. Everyone Active's Sporting Champions programme, in its 10th year, is open to emerging athletes eager to enhance their training. Since its inception, the initiative has aided more than 6,000 athletes nationwide, providing access to over 230 leisure centres, including Norfolk's The Reef Leisure Centre, Fakenham Sports and Fitness Centre, North Walsham Sports Centre, Victory Swim and Fitness Centre, and Cromer Sports Centre. Stuart Jardine, Everyone Active's area contract manager, said, "We are delighted to support up-and-coming athletes from North Norfolk on their journey to success. From this year, athletes aged over 16 who are accepted onto the scheme will also receive access to the U Plus membership, which is designed around wider health and well-being rather than just performance. Olympic silver medalist Colin Jackson is set to continue as ambassador for the 2026-27 programme, along with a group of Olympic and Paralympic athletes. In the past 9 years, the scheme has provided more than £2 million to support young athletes."
Charities and community groups have been invited to apply for funding to support their work. The Lovell Blake Community Fund is offering up to £2,000 per organisation from a total pot of £27,000. Organisations in Norfolk and Suffolk are eligible to apply. The fund is aimed at supporting small community groups, particularly those with annual incomes under £50,000 and a strong base of volunteers. Tracy Cox, chair of Lovell Blake's fundraising committee and grants panel, said she encourages applications from local groups, especially those operating at a grassroots level. The fund, set up in 2008, has distributed more than £420,000 to date. A recent recipient was Kettering Hall Cricket Club, which used its £2,000 grant to buy a new bowling machine. Applications for this round closes on Monday, April the 13th. More information and application forms are available at norfolkfoundation.com for Norfolk groups and suffolk.org.uk for Suffolk groups.
The introduction of a lower speed limit will cause delays on a major road. The A149, which runs from King's Lynn to Cromer, is getting a new 50-mile-an-hour limit put in place between Antingham and Thorpe Market. Work to install new signs and mark the road with the new limit will take place between March the 30th and April the 12th. The works are due to last for 2 weeks and be completed by Norfolk County Council teams and their contractors. During the day, the works will be carried out in sections using temporary two-way traffic lights. However, during the night, road closures will be in place. Access to homes and businesses will still be maintained throughout the project. Norfolk County Council has thanked people for their patience while the work is completed. The project, which will cost £50,000, is being conducted by the County Council's Infrastructure Department and its contractors.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Wilson. Editing and producing this issue was Trudy Box. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!